Fusionism is not the idea of fusing freedom and virtue. It is the idea that Western civilization and the Judeo-Christian ethic, and for that matter, the American Constitution, are based on two great truths, or embody two great truths. One is the importance of freedom, and the other is the importance of virtue. And neither one does terribly well without the other also being reasonably strong.
Join the best in the movement. It's Conservative Conversations with ISI, educating for liberty since 1953.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conservative Conversations with Johnny Burtka, Dan McCarthy, and Nate Hochman. Today's guest is Eugene Meyer, President and CEO of the Federalist Society, where he has served as Executive Director, CEO, and President of the organization for more than 30 years. Gene earned his BA in History at Yale and his MA in Political Science from the London School of Economics. Gene currently serves on the boards of the U.S. Chess Center, the Holman Foundation, the Sarah Scaife Foundation, and the advisory board of the Adam Smith Society. He holds the title of International Chess Master. Thanks for joining us today, Gene.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to our interview, we'd like to thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations. This podcast is a production of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. Our mission at ISI is to educate for liberty. If you'd like to help us in pursuing that mission, please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts to help us reach more listeners like yourself. Well, Gene, we are recording this podcast from the National Conservatism Conference in Miami, where you are speaking on a panel about fusionism. Some people on the panel will be criticizing fusionism, and others like yourself will be defending the tradition. And I think there's a lot of misperceptions when it comes to what fusionism actually is. I think perhaps the most common misperception is that fusionism was the alliance of, you know, foreign policy hawks, libertarians, and the religious right back during the Reagan years. Well, that certainly might be a manifestation of the fusionist coalition. That's not really the philosophy of fusionism that your father did such an excellent job describing. So I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about what your remarks will be tomorrow at the conference, and also perhaps on your thoughts on the national conservatism movement generally.
Well, thanks. Yeah, and you're exactly right. I mean, the idea of fusionism, I think a lot of people have the view that fusionism maybe was a useful alliance to defeat communism, and which was extremely important to defeat communism. But fusionism is not the idea of fusing freedom and virtue. It is the idea that Western civilization and the Judeo-Christian ethic, and for that matter, the American Constitution, are based on two great truths, or embody two great truths. One is the importance of freedom, and the other is the importance of virtue. And neither one does terribly well without the other also being reasonably strong. Because for virtue to be virtuous, needs to be freely chosen. If it's not freely chosen, it's not exactly clear why it is virtue, if ordinarily understood. And freedom without some kind of guide toward the good is likely to lead to sort of moral rot. So both freedom and virtue are critical aspects of a good society, and indeed of the civilization that the West has developed, and that Christianity and Judaism have developed.
So, Gene, I'm always interested in the sort of biographical background and development corresponds people's ideas and their personal experiences. So your father, Frank S. Meyer, is well known today for having been a senior editor at National Review. He became the main expositor of the philosophy of fusionism. And of course, fusionism was not his own term for his philosophy. It was one that was applied to the philosophy by one of its critics, L. Brent Bozell. And of course, it's nothing unusual in the history of ideas that ideas get christened by their critics rather than by their own progenitors. But your father had been a supporter of communism in his youth, and he became disillusioned by that ideology. He came to understand its evils. And he had grown up, I think, from a kind of secular Jewish background. And he became deeply interested as he left communism in studying the spiritual traditions of the West and getting to know not only sort of the Jewish perspective that he had overlooked in the past, but also he became very interested in natural law, in Catholicism, and in this broad sort of Western tradition. And you, of course, grew up in the household where Frank Meyer was engaged in this great personal odyssey of his. And I'm kind of curious how your own views have formed, what you consider to be sort of the taproot of your own sort of philosophical development.
Yeah, a couple things. My father, he was an active and something of a leader in the Communist Party in America in the 30s. He broke from the party during the war, spent about 7 or 8 years rethinking everything because communism is a totalitarian vision that covers every aspect of life. So he was rethinking all of that. And then he ultimately ended up gradually moving across the political spectrum. But part of it was the motive for communists and for many other ideologies which are at the end of the day evil. The motive is not that drives people to them. It's very often not evil at all. It's the idea of how do we live better lives? How do we help our fellow citizens, et cetera, et cetera? And what, you know, the type of ideas that lead someone in that direction can very much also lead someone to being very interested in religion, certainly in Christianity, in ways to make life better in the moral sense as well as the practical sense.
You know, I think one of the interesting things or interesting divisions within a lot of the conservatives at conferences like National Conservatism is whether or not what the project of something like National Conservatism is a rejection of traditional conservative principles like fusionism or a renewal of a richer, more robust understanding. So I think, I mean, this debate happens about something like the founding, for example, too, where you have the most radical right wingers who say that they're rejecting the founding. And then you have a lot of the, in my opinion, correct folks at conferences like National Conservatism who are saying it's not that the founding was flawed, at least in the sort of way that it's indicted by post-liberals. It's just that conservatives in the modern day have misinterpreted what the founders were about. Do you see National Conservatism and the sort of political milieu that it occupies as a rejection of fusionism, as I think some National Conservatives argue, or do you think it's consistent with a fusionism properly understood?
Yes. very much both things are going on. I would say that Whitaker Chambers had this one wonderful phrase in one of his letters to Buckley, where he talks about each age has to find its own words for the eternal truths. I think that's a lot of what goes on often, and including partially in this case. The basic idea of fusionism is true. Yes, was true yesterday, is true today, and will be true tomorrow, in my view. The human beings to live, to flourish, to live the best lives they can, need both freedom and virtue. And politically, you have to secure freedom. Virtue is much broader than just the political factors. There are all kinds of things you need to do for that. And you know, you have one set of views in a given time that's dependent on certain circumstances that you frame very effectively. Then for later generations, there are going to be different circumstances, but the same core truths will still exist, but you have to find the words that will appeal and will be best understood by that generation.
Gene, I'm curious, one way that I've heard fusionism described is that the end of government is freedom, but the ends of, you know, private life or associational life is virtue. And that's sort of the prism by which they judge is the government doing a policy that is just or unjust by whether or not it lines up with that sort of scheme. I'm wondering, is that a true reading of fusionism? And then the follow-up question to that is one of, you know, our friends Josh Hammer is arguing for a common good constitutionalism. And he says, no, in the American system, sort of the ends laid out in the preamble to the Constitution, those are the legitimate ends. Freedom is one of those, but it's one among several others, including the general welfare. So I'm curious if you could comment on both of those.
Yeah, I'd love to. I think I basically would agree with the original statement about, you know, the end is freedom, you know, the governmental end is freedom. I do think that libertarians make an error when they say that freedom the key thing is freedom, and you know, and sort of you do whatever you want to do with it. Well, you are free to do whatever you want to do with it, and should be under government. But that doesn't mean that what you do, that one should be indifferent to what you do with it. The core of what you are going to be as a human being is dependent on what you actually do with that freedom. It's very important. It's just not, it's not a governmental role, except at the margins, insofar as government, you know, government does make a variety of choices of necessity, and a lot of the non-coercive choices government makes, you know, it's perfectly reasonable to include considerations of you know, things which are, you know, which encourage virtue more than encourage vice. But the core question is getting a government that by and large makes its citizens as free as possible from coercion at home and abroad, and then relies on the rest of the institutions of society to encourage good behavior and virtuous behavior. When you try to do things differently, there are major challenges because, and I'll bridge over to what Josh Hammer was saying. The problem with sort of the common good originalism idea that he's talking about, which is to a significant degree an idea about law and how judges should interpret things, is when you say, well, we want judges to interpret things the way to reach good policy results, you know, you don't have any answer to somebody who says, well, this judge reached what he thought was good policy results, and what I think is good policy results. I'm sorry you didn't like it. That's tough. And the answer to that really is we have a structure of government which makes it clear what the role of the different branches are. The separation of powers is so crucial to our structure of government because it's what contains human nature, which otherwise will lead to excessive concentrations of power. That's the idea of dividing power. And the other key thing there is you want judges to be saying when something violates the Constitution. You don't want them to be trying to guide policy. That's the role of Congress, and executing is the role of the president or the executive. And whenever a branch gets out of its lane, it's usually to accumulate more power. If they succeed, then they'll want to accumulate yet more power. That is what the framers so brilliantly designed the Constitution in so many ways to guard against.
And virtue ultimately has to be rooted in the people. So, Gene, I know you and I are going to be on a panel discussing fusionism at the end of this conference, and I'll be referring to Wilmore Kendall, and this was one of his major points, that you know, the more hierarchical and top-down kind of structures that many conservatives find inspiring are important. But actually, if you do not have a well-grounded virtue in the people, everything else that you try to build on a higher level is going to collapse. And we see that right now happening with the fact that we've overturned Roe v. Wade. We have the Dobbs decision, which has sent abortion policy back to the states. And it really depends now on the virtue of the people in the states in order to make the right laws. I wanted to shift and maybe ask you about your father's views on a lot of the controversies of the 1960s, especially as the counterculture got started. So what many people may not know about Frank Meyer, they tend to think of him just as a libertarian, and so they may associate him with a number of libertarian causes, you know, things like drug legalization and so forth. But your father was actually quite a strong critic of the campus counterculture of the 1960s and of the attack upon reason, attack upon Western civilization. It was already very intense back then. I'm kind of wondering what you think about his views of those things and what you think of the situation today with respect to the sort of campus culture and the counterculture left that now seems to be dominant in our society.
Well, he was extremely upset at the way in which the counterculture was affecting things because, well, one of the things I remember is bellowing around the living room at times where people would talk about they feel X, they feel Y, they feel whatever. And he said, feel. Damn it, don't people think anymore? One of his classic things. But he viewed the, you know, there's a very strong Burkean element to things as well. You don't say, oh, we ignore all the traditions that have been developed and just do whatever, you know, and just reinvent everything from scratch. You don't dismiss the learnings and knowledge and wisdom of the generations past without first fully understanding them and knowing exactly why you're dismissing them. And he was very, very worried about the whole thing was going on. Then he'd be even more worried, if anything, today. And he would say, I think, so much of this, it's not exactly Marxist, but so much of the wokeism is developed from various far left views designed to break up the society that exists in one way or another, break up the traditions of the West, break up the traditions of the Judeo-Christian ethic. And his view was the Constitution, American Constitution, is the best we've done so far. It was built out of, it encompasses a governing structure to support the civilization that had been developed over thousands of years. And he viewed the 60s as attacking that civilization in a lot of ways.
It seems like, you know, obviously the debates within conservatism sort of occur along two different axes. So one is the sort of abstract philosophical first principles debates, which is often where the debates over fusionism occupy. And then the other is the sort of material policy debates. But I wonder if fusionism counsels in one direction or another on a lot of the sort of controversial policy disputes in terms of substantive public policy within conservatism today. Because obviously, one of the sort of indictments of fusionism you hear from right-wing skeptics of it as a first principles framework is that it's excessively libertarian, and that in sort of counseling libertarian means toward traditionalist ends, you ultimately just arrive at libertarian means. But is there a correct sort of fusionist way to think about something such as, you know, DeSantis revoking Disney's tax status, for example, which has obviously been the source of some controversy within conservatism today? Or does it not sort of specifically point in one direction or another when it comes to actual nuts and bolts policy?
I think it is a philosophical approach to how one goes about governing, and I don't think it necessarily takes a position on many of the specific issues that come up. I am speculating, I admit, but I think my father would have been quite enthusiastic about DeSantis, because I think you can make arguments both ways. Neither one is inconsistent with the commitment to freedom. Obviously, tax policies already, you know, it's the nature of government has to tax. However it taxes is going to have an effect in some way or other, and you can certainly debate those policies. I think there'd be more of a question. I'm not sure it's definitive in terms of an answer. There'd be more of a question about reining in the tech companies, I think, because there's at least a challenge that, well, wait a minute, government shouldn't be doing this. And then you can make some counterarguments, but government shouldn't be doing this. I think in terms of tax policy, you know, that's much more of a directly political choice. But I don't think, I think what you look to, the way I look at it is, the importance of freedom exists throughout Christianity, to some degree, even in Judaism, in the American Constitution. But so much of what some of the people who are skeptical of fusionism want to do is stuff they should be doing. They should be doing it through the various engines of society, but not through law. So if people are living immoral lives, in this sense, I would very much disagree with John Stuart Mill, if for all his libertarianism objected also to people, saying that certain things were bad. That's not a function, as a function of freedom. Freedom cuts both ways. And certainly people ought to be able to argue for all kinds of ways to promote a more virtuous and good and better society, and indeed ought to be encouraged to do so. Just the uses of the force of government need to be very limited because of the huge coercive power they have, because of the threat of force they have, and because the more government power is used, the larger it gets. And I challenge you to find any situation in human society where really large, enormous concentrations of power don't get abused, usually badly abused.
One quick follow-up just on the sort of fusionism and policy framework. I don't know that immigration necessarily occupied as dominant of a place in political debates when Frank Meyer was writing, but did he have anything in particular to say about the concept of, you know, borders or immigration? Because obviously there's an argument you hear from a lot of libertarians that fidelity to liberty and sometimes even constitutional principles militates in favor of something approximating open borders. That's obviously something that most conservatives disagree with. Do you think did Frank Meyer write anything about immigration, and do you think fusionism has anything to say about that debate?
I don't think he wrote much about immigration. He wrote a fair bit about America. He believed in the country. He was certainly very strongly against any form of world government or the United Nations or having that kind of influence, etc. He may have written something. He certainly didn't write extensively on it. I think there are aspects of it. I feel very confident that he would say that the way in which some of the more purely open border stuff, and certainly admitting people and providing them all kinds of government assistance, he would, I'm sure, had major doubts about. On the other hand, I'm speculating. I think he probably, to some degree, would have been enthusiastic about the idea of America as a country of immigrants, as a country based on ideas. I mean, I know he would believe strongly in the American dream, and the American dream would be a good, is a really good and valuable thing. But certainly at this conference, my goal in terms of fusionism and in general is to encourage the understanding that it is a philosophy talking about the incredible value of and good of both freedom and virtue, and trying to help us understand that both to fully flourish need the other to be doing well.
Gene, we have a biography coming out about your father by Daniel Flynn. And so that'll dive into his life and influences in some more detail. But I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that 7 to 8 year period where he transitioned from communism to conservatism, to the right side of the political spectrum. Maybe could you touch on who some of his chief intellectual and philosophical influences were?
Should be talking to my brother, not me, actually. He's an older brother, and my father died when I was 19. So I don't know as much about this as I might. But I think both Hazlitt and Hayek at different points had some influence. But he was widely read, and I think there were a number of different people who had an impact. I think the thing, I can tell you one kind of interesting thing of when he broke from the Communist Party. In part, it was because he ended up going into the military, although he was too old to do it in World War II, or to be required to do it, because the communists approved of that after the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union. And he viewed himself as speaking out and helping, all the workers in the country, et cetera, who were mistreated. And then he encountered all these average, ordinary Americans. And it became pretty clear to him, they weren't the ones who were coming to the communist rallies. These were the average, ordinary guys. And they didn't seem to feel that way. And I think he began to think, well, if this is what we're working for, wait, what's going on? So that caused some doubts. There are a whole bunch of things that started causing doubts. He and my mother, they were both in the party. They met in the party, but they had a close marriage. He started raising questions. My mother said, nah, that's not really a problem. And then at some stage, my mother said, after another question, I said, well, Frank, if this is the way it is, why are we part of this? And my father says, no, not so fast. And they sort of leapfrogged their ways out of the party, I think. So I think the break with it was more seeing all the various problems. And once you start thinking about it, realizing that this ideal to make for an ideal government or a better government was not working, and gradually realizing it probably could not work and that much evil was being done in its name. So then you have to rethink everything, because totalitarian is a literal meaning. I don't have lunch with you unless there's a purpose for the party if I'm a good communist. I'm either trying to convert you or influence you in some way, but everything is done in service of the party if you're a good communist. So at that stage, you know, you have to really rethink everything because your purpose of what you do daily is changed. Totally.
You know, following on from Johnny's question, the Cold War, of course, was an important backdrop in the days of your father's life and the creation of fusionism as a philosophy. And I know one of the differences between your father and some of the more radical libertarians were on the issue of foreign policy, where Murray Rothbard and others were very much non-interventionist, even in the face of the Soviet threat. Now, I know that a lot of other fusionists, some of our friends like Donald Devine, for example, have, since the end of the Cold War, come back to the sort of traditional American foreign policy view, a very limited degree of intervention in world affairs. And many fusionists are now closer to the non-interventionist camp than into the camp of, you know, sort of neoconservatives who might favor a more aggressive foreign policy. What are your views on sort of what fusionism itself says about foreign policy? Or is foreign policy kind of outside of the domain of the order and virtue questions that fusionism addresses directly?
Let me first talk about my father's views, because here I do know something. He viewed, you know, communism from the inside as a threat to our existence. I'm sure he would say, if he were here, that our victory was not preordained in spite of the mess the Soviet Union was. If they, for example, could have gotten nuclear superiority, they could have blackmailed their way out of any economic problems they had. I know he thought, you know, he thought Reagan was, I mean, he did not live to see Reagan elected, but he thought Reagan was the best politician he'd ever met by far in terms of his substance as well as his abilities. And he would have loved what Reagan did. So but in terms of, you know, I guess the guide you have is the importance of freedom and the importance of defending America so it can be the society we want it to be. So that some of this is very much prudential questions. He would not have been sympathetic to the idea of making the world safe for democracy. He would have thought that was, I'm sure of that. But he would have thought that, you need to probably be pretty involved, because if you aren't, particularly as the world changes, a much more isolationist posture was probably much more practical at an earlier stage than it probably is today. So, and a lot of the things are not going to be answered, I think. You know, the commitment to freedom and commitment to virtue is a guide to how you think about policy. It doesn't give you the policy answers. Those you have to work out, and you can debate vigorously, and that's great, and that's fine, and that's welcome. But you can't expect, well, or you shouldn't, you know, what fusionism talks about doesn't tell you the specific positions you have on a lot of the specific issues that you've got to work out. But you work it out from a framework where if it doesn't end up leading to good results for freedom, and it doesn't, and it ends up making society in some way a less virtuous country, well, then you know that you have to rethink and come up with something that does better in those two counts.
With the obvious caveat that, as you were just saying, Gene, fusionism doesn't counsel specific policy prescriptions in most areas. Do you think, on a first principles level, current situation in what is generally sort of, you know, colloquially referred to as woke capital or woke capitalism, which is the concentration of power in private institutions that are proactively using their enormous institutional power to advance a variety of radical left-wing cultural causes, do you think that requires or necessitates a rethinking of the sort of balance between liberty and virtue within fusionism, at least as it pertains to the use of state power or public policy? Because, you know, in a previous era, there might have been a more convincing case that government bureaucracy, for example, was a threat to virtue in civil society. Whereas today, while government bureaucracy still obviously poses a threat, we are also facing this new kind of threat from concentrated corporate power to the virtuous society.
I'll say a couple things, and I should mention, because obviously I'm mostly known in terms of the Federalist Society, that the specific views here are my own, not the society, since we don't take positions on issues in that way. On the one hand, certainly there are all kinds of problems with the all these sorts of things that are going on. And we definitely need to find everywhere we can to try to fight against the woke developments in all these areas. There's a principled argument against the role of government, which one obviously has to consider. There's also a practical argument, which is, when has government successfully done anything of that sort? Certainly in this country. It seems to me that whenever government gets involved in public policy battles of that type to do good, that's not how it comes out. For the Tolkien fans on your podcast, there's this wonderful passage where at different times, both Gandalf and someone else was offered the ring and are told by one of the hobbits, "You'd do good with it." And the response is, "Yes, that is how it would start. But alas, it's not how it would end." And that's the you know, when you rely on government to solve the sort of problems that should be solved by the little platoons, by the various other institutions of society, you run the danger of not having them play the role they need to play, which is one of the ways in which society stays healthy. So that would be a warning I would want to think very carefully about. I'm not saying there's never a situation or never a time when something might not be justified, but it's a high bar. And the specific thing I would think of would be, is kind of identified in the sort of thing that we're fighting against. It's not hard to imagine government doing exactly the problems that these companies are doing, except with the additional force of government behind them. And indeed, there seems to be some things coming out that government was linked with some of the things that we're concerned about. So saying the answer is government regulating it would cause me major questions. And from a fusionist point of view, I think it would cause, you know, it's a major question in terms of freedom. And the answer should be countervailing activities. You have this classic antitrust problem. You know, when you had trains, well, there's a limited number of tracks. Now, yeah, you can start something, but the tech companies are so powerful, they can probably make it very difficult for you to succeed. And that's a struggle and an argument one has to have. But I don't think there's a definitive answer, but I think there's a major cause for serious question about trying to use government in that way. But there's some really serious problems that need to be addressed.
Gene, your mention of Tolkien reminds me that your family has a strong literary tradition, and you yourself are, in fact, named for Eugene O'Neill.
I was indeed, I was named for Eugene O'Neill, but you may be wrong in what you're thinking, and certainly most of the listeners will be confused, because I was not named for the playwright. I was named for his son, Eugene O'Neill Jr., who was my father's best friend. It was a funny thing, because I had, you know, I mean, I knew I was named after him, but I hadn't specifically thought much of anything. And I think the first time I saw a play on Broadway, it was a Eugene O'Neill play, and I fell totally in love with theater and if we ever really want, we got serious about solving the drug problem, and we had put sufficient resources into it and found enough really good actors, I just have them watch. Well, I just have Show Long Day's Journey Into Night all over the country, because that's the strongest anti-drug message I've ever seen.
Gene, we're about out of time here, but I think it's really special that you are a chess master. So why don't we end with a chess-related question? What is it like playing chess, you know, at such a high level? I know Netflix has made some movies about it recently. I'm trying to understand your experience, what it's taught you about life. And also, do you have a favorite opening move? How do you think about how you're going to start off the game?
Well, I'm going to answer the question a little bit differently from what it was asked, because I interviewed a lot of the top Russian chess players who either defected or emigrated from the Soviet Union, on why of all the people who left, did they leave with chess being so big in the Soviet Union, and not really a way to make a living here, although some of them managed to scrape it out. The two very quick stories. One, this guy who was saying, you know, look, I was a skeptic. I didn't believe anything I heard from the Soviets. But I was disappointed when I first came here to see the Americans lie too, because I went to the Kitty Hawk Museum and they were talking about the Wright brothers flying the first plane. And everybody knows that Mr. Muzsinski flew the first plane. And he, by then he knew this was untrue, but it was something he believed by the time he told me, but he believed this at the time. You know, it's interesting. The Soviets were so committed to having the best chess players in the world, because they thought it demonstrated something about intelligence, and I certainly can link to intelligence in some ways, but they way overrated that aspect of things. But it's an interesting thing because it is completely independent of other things. A great thing is you can watch a little kid from poor background, disadvantaged background, whatever. They can compete with adults or with other kids from much better backgrounds on a totally equal setting. Because the only thing you have in chess is the ability to count to about three or four. So you can say, well, three pieces attack this and two pieces defend it. So I've got more on that square than the other person does. But it's an independent set of rules, but very much intellectually oriented. And it's a really fun thing to try to work through a game like that that's totally separate from everything else, except you have a set of rules and how do you apply them?
Well, on that note, thanks so much for being with us, Gene. If people want to follow you or find more of your work, where can they find you?
Well, probably the best, probably mostly my organization, which is fedsoc.org, FEDSOC.org is what the Federal Society does and works on all kinds of legal and constitutional issues. In its way, in the legal area, it very much takes after, I like to think it takes after my father and takes after the commitment to fusionism, the commitment to freedom, and the commitment to a good society and virtue.
Great. And if there are any ISI students headed to law school, I would strongly encourage you to get plugged in with FedSoc. Thank you all for listening to Conservative Conversations with ISI. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please feel free to head over to isi.org/resources to see all that we offer our members, including the Intercollegiate Review, select Modern Age articles, ISI books, and of course, this podcast. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to rate and review, and we will see you next time on Conservative Conversations with ISI.